need to do anything to
Rosamund. No, I've been thinking about your name all week. It's such a beautiful name.
What did you teach?
Well, they probably indoors.
Oh, the student voice. Communication.
So welcome back. I've missed a few of you last week. My name's Gloria Moorman. I'm not a cartographer. I'm part book historian, part Italianist. I'm also currently finishing my PhD here at the center, specializing in 17th century atlases. So what I would like to do tonight is generally think through some of the implications of the reemergence of Ptolemy's geography in the Renaissance by looking at its influence mainly in maps and atlas books issued both in Italy and in the Low Countries, works that differ both in terms of their contents and materiality. Now, what I mean when I say that is that generally we're going to look at things from a book historical perspective, in the sense that we'll consider not just the contents of books, but also their broader social-cultural meaning, and we'll look at book ownership and its connection to libraries and Renaissance collections. Before I start with the lecture part of what I've prepared for tonight, I wanted to briefly introduce some possible questions or possible avenues for thought, really, related to how we approach maps, and then maybe we can return to some of these in this seminar. Firstly, something that I've been thinking about quite a bit over the past years, if there's a universal way to look at maps. One of the things I've noticed when I was observing not just maps and atlases myself, but also sometimes found myself looking at people observing maps in libraries and museums, is that generally viewers seem keen to identify places that they actually already know, but that they feel somehow connected to, including places where they live, the place where they were born, places that they have traveled to. So I'm just wondering, what is it about maps that seems to resonate so strongly with our sense of belonging to certain places, through either memories or imagined experiences we hope to have in the future? What is it about maps that connects us to where we are, where we have been, or where we would like to go? So my main aim or hope for tonight is that we can start looking at early modern maps with slightly different eyes, by becoming aware of the intentional interplay between natural and cultural notions, ancient heritage versus modern advances, inscribed in the map not as a neutral lens on our surroundings, but rather as a charged carrier of cultural messages. Recently, the persuasive power of cartography was noted by the editors of The Economist, who stated that maps are often thought of as records of facts and terrain, rather than actors in history. Yet a map does not merely illustrate the lie of the land. It is also an instrument of persuasion. So for now, I'm going to just leave the questions on the slide behind me, but I'd be just generally happy to talk about them a bit more in the second hour. I've also brought some additional visual material, so maps that we can look at all together, if you're interested in that.
Excuse me, would you have a spare one of those, please?
I think Jane does, so I'll just ask afterwards. To Renaissance cartographers, the Geography, an introductory treatise compiled by the Greek astronomer Claudius Ptolemaeus, or Ptolemy, during the 2nd century, represented much more than a mere manual for map-making. Its 8 volumes, containing lists of the distances between places known at the time and concrete definitions for the organization of space, in fact provided a new mental framework or a language to imagine our surroundings and map specific sites visually. At the end of the 14th century, the Geography resurfaced for the first time after the Middle Ages in Greek manuscripts that were brought to Florence upon the arrival of Byzantine humanist Manuel Kisoloros, when he took up the chair in Greek at the University of Florence in 1397. The work incited great enthusiasm among learned and mercantile circles and was reissued in numerous editions in both Latin or vernacular translation. It received countless contemporary commentaries. A good example of the practical and cultural interpretations of the Geography that proliferated in Renaissance Italy is the late 16th century commentary by the Bolognese scholar and himself, interestingly enough, an atlas maker, Antonio Maggini, that was printed in Venice. Maggini echoed a view that we find repeated in countless other editions, stating that geography is different from chorography because the latter, dividing particular places, exposes them separately and each according to itself. and together it describes almost all the things contained within them, like the harbors, the towns, the peoples, rivers, and other similar things. Where it is proper to geography to show all in one, the objective of choreography is to represent a sole part, just like it would imitate or paint a single ear or an eye. 16th century humanists generally considered choreography as a combination of natural and cultural aspects in detailed descriptions of a country, a region, or a city. Choreography was furthermore understood as the opposite, on the one hand, of geography, pertaining to the entire known surface of the earth, and of cosmography, devoted on a greater scale to both the earth and the surrounding skies. As we shall see, the understanding of these concepts by individual authors or publishers could, however, vary considerably. In fact, the period from the 16th to the late 17th century witnessed shifting views on the scope and purposes of cosmography that could range from a chronological representation of geographical and historical features that were, necessarily, arranged in close accordance to one another, to the interpretation of cosmography as simply a visual manifestation of the natural and cultural variety within the known world. According to Dario Testicini, throughout the 16th century, different definitions and evaluations, of the role of cosmography were circulating. What cosmography aimed to represent was the harmony and proportion that bound the world together. Yet this picture would radically change from the end of the 17th century, when geography began to be considered as a branch of knowledge dealing with the surface of the earth. It then took on the meaning of a description and a representation of the physical features of our surrounding space, including the disposition of seas, rivers, and continents, as well as human settlements, such as countries, cities, roads, and harbors. In the final part of this lecture, we will have a look at some of the contents of an exceptional 17th century atlas to see just how flexible an individual book owner's engagement with the Ptolemaic model could be. First, however, I would like us to consider the ideological and more practical implications arising from the geography between 16th and 17th century works from Italy and the Low Countries. In line with the aim of geographical and cultural harmony through mathematical proportion, a universal cosmography in the Ptolemaic sense needed to describe both the terrestrial and celestial world, while it would furthermore incorporate and possibly even reconcile natural and cultural history. The highly ambitious nature of such a pursuit and its potential to appeal to a vast and varied readership across different geographical and linguistic areas shine through in a passage by Pietro Andrea Mattioli in his Italian translation of Ptolemy's Geography that was published again in Venice in 1548. The science of cosmography is of use not just to philosophers, theologists, astronomers, medics, legal scholars, orators, poets, and other learned men in any science to better themselves with the truth of those things of the world that relate to their sciences. But it, so here he means cosmography, is also necessary to princes, to rulers of republics, to leaders of armed men, to captains and admirals of armies at sea, to privateers, to soldiers, to merchants, to gentlemen, and the most gentle women, to travelers and pilgrims, and finally to each gentle spirit that wants to know what this world of ours is. So he clearly is trying to present his own translation as if there's literally something for everybody in there. With this knowledge, one knows not only the world as a whole, but in particular, the regions, the provinces, the islands, the seas, the lakes, the mountains, the forests, the cities, the peoples, the habits and laws one finds there. Additionally, one may, with this noble science, promptly know under what climate and province or city any part of the world lies, and what the distance is from one place to another. In this way, with the science of geography, anyone can be like an eagle or a falcon, which, soared into the upper regions of the sky, circles there thanks to one of nature's special gifts and surveys all parts of the world. So we conclude that without any risk and without the effort of long journeys, the reader can, with the sciences of both cosmography and geography, know clearly every single detail of the entire universe. So quite a promise, actually. In the 17th century, the Dutch printer-publishers Willem and Johan Blau, to which I will return, adjusted their cosmographical aspirations even more specifically to the demands of audiences eager to pursue armchair travels whilst leisurely leafing through an atlas book. In the preface to the Toneel des Aardrijks, the Dutch version of their Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, a work containing 207 maps depicting the countries of the world, Willem and Johan Blau write, We wander through and visit the entire world at no cost and swiftly move, without any trouble or discomfort, from east to west, from south to north, at the speed of our eyes and thoughts. And yet what is more fun and entertaining than to see before one's eyes, from images and descriptions of the world, the great empires and far-flung countries of so many kings and sovereigns, than to know the differences between so many landscapes, cities and villages, how and how far they are positioned in respect of one another, than to note the situation of waters, gulfs and promontories, to understand, moreover, the diverse nature and cities of so many peoples and what such a land produces and renders. The Blaus had taken inspiration for the concept and contents of their atlas, as is visible in its Latin title, from the Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, a work published by Avram Ortelius that is generally considered the first modern atlas book. The antiquarian cartographer Ortelius was active in Antwerp, the centre of 16th century printing and publishing, located in the southern Low Countries. By the time Avram Ortelius set up his book and antiquary business in the city in about 1554, he found himself at the heart of a thriving community of scholars, printers and publishers. Born in Antwerp on 14 April 1527 and trained originally as an engraver, Ortelius began to take a particular interest in map-making around 1560, probably under the influence of his friend Gerard Mercator, a cartographer who in 1538 had produced his first map of the world. Mercator's first contemporary biographer, Walter Gim, claims that Mercator had started preparing the publication of a series of maps of particular regions and the world in its entirety, in small size, long before Ortelius started working on what would become his large-size atlas. Mercator is even believed to have quite consciously delayed the completion of his maps until Ortelius had brought out his Theatrum Orbis Terrarum and had sold a considerable number of copies of the work. Later scholars have argued, however, that despite the fact that this story can be taken as a truthful reflection of the friendly spirit which united the two men, Mercator, because he was so attentive to accuracy and did most of the engraving himself, could never have been ready by 1570. Although Mercator's influence on Ortelius should not be underestimated, the attribution of the invention of the atlas concept to him alone would be a great simplification. Earlier Portolan atlases, books containing maps based on the points of the compass and the estimated distances between ports as these were actually observed by pilots at sea, for instance, or medieval books containing maps as a prominent feature, must have been crucial in paving the way for the later elaboration of the atlas concept by Mercator, Ortelius, and other publishers. The scholars that credit Ortelius with introducing the atlas concept, however, are right in the sense that the Theatrum was, at its moment of publication, the most carefully compiled and planned edition of maps of the world that had yet been produced. According to Ortelius himself, he had first come up with the novel idea of uniting individual maps into a single atlas book when he was asked by Gilles Hoofdman, a wealthy Antwerp merchant, to provide him with a series of maps covering the coasts of Europe in a convenient container or material medium. In order to satisfy Hoofdman, Ortelius then decided to compile a book that was to contain 38 maps. Following the compilation of this bespoke cartographic album for Hoofdman, Ortelius spent at least a further 10 years planning his more standardized atlas, so the Theatrum, for which he selected and then edited maps from previously published works or from drafts that were supplied by friends and correspondents. In this way, he was able to collect the best maps available in Europe at the time. After they had all been brought down to the same size, he then united them in a single book. In Ortelius's message to the reader, included in every edition of the Theatrum, the cartographer himself states that he had been concerned chiefly with matters of practicality, the inconveniences of handling large wall maps, when he first thought of producing an atlas. Therefore, the maps helped the student whose main interest lies in the study of history. Were it not that because of limited space, large charts cannot be opened and inspected easily because of their size. Those large geographical maps and charts, which are folded or rolled up, are not so commodious, nor, when they are being read, are they easy to inspect. And whoever wants to hang them on a wall will not only need a very large house, but even a king's gallery or a theatre. Whereas Ortelius here stresses the convenient size of his atlas, as opposed to the challenging physicality of large wall maps, another innovation introduced in Ortelius's paper theatre, the Theatrum, are the texts printed on the reverse of the map sheets. on this additional advantage allowed by the Atlas Book, Ortelius comments less straightforwardly. In his 1570 Latin address, Ortelius explains that he has included additional geographical information for the curious reader, whereas in the same text in the Dutch edition, Ortelius introduces the accompanying texts in the vernacular, as if these were meant simply to provide a pleasant distraction for the less experienced reader, supposedly a bit tired from mentally going over all the regions depicted in the atlas. Alongside editions with texts in Latin and Dutch, Ortelius produced editions of his work in French, German, Spanish, Italian, and English. Generally, two different types of audience have been identified, one for the Latin and one for the vernacular editions of the Theatrum. On the one hand, the vernacular texts, including practical information and relatively straightforward descriptions of particular regions, were probably intended for a readership of wealthy but not necessarily academically trained individuals, such as civil servants and the merchants mentioned by Matteoli in his translation of the geography. The Latin texts that were provided by Ortelius in his atlas, with many references to and quotations from classical literature, were meant for a more scholarly audience that would profit from Ptolemy's full intellectual potential. Through the use of Latin, furthermore, an international readership outside the French and Dutch-speaking areas could be reached. Ortelius was, however, not the first to take the leap from an individual compilation of maps, produced at the request of a particular buyer, to a more standardized selection of cartographical content produced as album of printed maps, or more specifically, in the shape of a bound book that, as opposed to a manuscript volume, could theoretically be reprinted interminably. In the 16th century, maps showing different parts of the world circulated not just in the type of map books that started to appear from roughly the 1550s onwards, such as in Ortelius's Theatrum, and that are generally associated with the atlas today. Scholars including Francesca Fiorani have argued that historically the idea of the modern atlas of the world found its first realization not in printed books, but rather in cycles of painted maps displayed on the walls of buildings throughout Europe. Both wall maps and atlas books present a coherent geographical narrative through edited selections of cartographic material that may be read by their respective audiences, either by leafing through a bound volume or walking through a painted map cycle. Besides their conceptual similarities, painted maps, of course, also differ fundamentally from their printed counterparts. Their meaning depends to a large extent on the fixed cycles being displayed in a strictly defined three-dimensional space, which would have originally secured the relationship between individual maps and between the maps and other decorative elements present in their physical surroundings. Some of the map cycles introduced to courts and palaces throughout Europe predated the map books to which they are undoubtedly historically related. Others were based on new geographical investigations or depended on original combinations of manuscript and printed source material. The keen interest of Abraham Ortelius in the creation of the Vatican Gallery of Maps, the Galleria delle Carte Geografiche, executed by the Dominican Ignazio Danti for Pope Gregory XIII, is indicative of the links between map cycles and the atlas. In July 1592, so roughly 20 years after the first edition of the Theatrum was issued in Antwerp, Ortelius was sent a letter by an acquaintance of his in Rome, the antiquarian scholar Philip van Wingen, in which van Wingen elaborates on Dante's map of the Lazio area and even attaches a hand-drawn copy made on site after the original fresco. On van Wingen's drawing, however carefully executed, many of the original's details were left out. According to van Wingen himself, he had only been able to draw a hasty copy of the map with great trouble and in great heat, so imagine this is Rome in July, after various efforts to get access to the galleries, factors that all underscore the prestigious sociocultural context often surrounding painted map cycles. On painted map cycles, such as the one at the Vatican, many minute elements whose absence could easily go unnoticed on smaller printed maps had to be added, simply because of their monumental size. The relation between printed atlases and painted cycles was evidently more complex than one of mere source and copy. This stood out clearly to the Renaissance nobles, who often hired professional cartographers to plan their map cycles. The connection between the two is complicated, for instance, by obvious differences in the work's physical characteristics. Theoretically, in atlases, as observed by Jürgen Schultz, all maps were meant for private consumption, to be enjoyed alone in the seclusion of one's study or in the company of a few like-minded spirits. While painted map cycles could, at least potentially, be viewed by a greater group of people simultaneously. The painted map's interpretation as being part of an either publicly shared or intimate space, and its implications for the work's accessibility, clearly influenced the patron's choices regarding the inclusion or exclusion of certain cartographic elements, and the ways in which these would be rendered. The interplay between commissioner and consumer, interested in either selling or purchasing a more or less standardized selection of cartographic material that corresponded to the intended audience's preferences, was a significant factor that shaped the appearance of unique painted cycles, so including the one at the Vatican, and of atlas books issued in seemingly standardized editions. Ortelius's interest in Ignazio Danti's work at the Vatican is closely connected to the innovative character of some of the contents of the Galleria delle Carte Geografiche, completed by Danti and a team of papal artists between early 1580 and mid-1581. During the 16th century, in fact, the mural maps of Lazio executed in the Vatican Palace were the very first new administrative maps of the chorographic type, so now here we go back to Ptolemy and his concepts, issued in central Italy, dedicated to small areas and showing natural and cultural detail on what our modern eyes may perhaps, slightly anachronistically, consider a microscopic scale. The Patrimonium San Petri and Latium et Sabina, witnessed by von Winge in the 1590s, seem meant especially to underscore the lasting power of the Holy See over parts of the papal state immediately surrounding Rome. Within the Galleria as a whole, the maps furthermore form part of 38 views of the regions of the Italian peninsula, complemented by two maps in which ancient and modern Italy are compared. Encapsulated, in turn, by the ceremonious papal collections at the Vatican, Danti's maps become closely connected components structured within intertwined geographical and social messages adjusted to the agendas of powerful rulers at the heart of the Catholic Church. Attention to natural and cultural detail is equally visible in this map, dedicated to the urban and volcanic characteristics of the island of Ischia in southern Italy, that was produced in 1586 by Mario Cartaro for the medical scholar Giulio Iassolino. Based on extensive research in the area around Naples, the map was probably meant to promote the practice of thermal bathing on the island, perhaps as a substitute for the hot water springs that had become inaccessible in the wake of seismic activity and the birth of the Monte Nuovo volcano near the coastal city of Pozzuoli in 1538. Iassolino had first published a map in his work De rimedi naturali che sono nell'isola di Ischia, or On the Natural Remedies That Are on the Island of Ischia, that was published in Naples in 1588. For centuries, the image first presented by Iassolino and Cartago, in close connection to the text of the De Rimedi, remained a point of reference for European cartographers showing Ischia to their respective audiences. This confirms the flexible characteristic of cartography, and especially chorography, between single-sheet maps and atlases in which text and imagery appear in close conjunction. The first to use Cartago's map as a prototype and make it accessible to audiences in northern Europe was Ortelius. He inserted a simplified version dated 1590 and based entirely on the Iassolino-Cartago map, despite the removal of several details, in his 1592 edition of the Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, where it is complemented by a textual description that was sometimes annotated by more studious readers. The first Italian reproduction of Cartago's map appeared in Giovanni Maggini's Regno di Napoli, an atlas edited and published after his death by his son Fabio in 1620. In 1662, Johann Blau in Amsterdam reissued the Ischia map and included it in the eighth volume of his Atlas Major, to which I will come back. In 1704, a re-engraved edition of the Blau map was published under the French title L'Île d'Ischia by Peter Mortier. So you can really see that it goes from all sorts of audiences, switching also languages. A well-preserved copy of the Ischia map is currently preserved at the Newberry Library in Chicago, where it forms part of the SAC map collection, based on the over 1,300 items brought together between 1720 and 1750 by the Swedish Baron John Gabriel Säck in what we may consider his personal, individually compiled atlas album. The Italian peninsula is among the territories best represented in Säck's collection, testifying to his lively interest in the politics of the region, although he never actually travelled there himself. Säck eventually had almost half of his maps bound into two large volumes with a solid leather binding to keep the individual maps, some of which had to be folded, in good condition. One of these volumes, including the map of Ischia, has now been disbound for conservation purposes at the Newbury Library, where its contents can be consulted as separate prints. So it really goes from separate prints to atlas, and then it goes back to separate prints again, all for the sake of conservation. By including an astonishing amount of cultural and natural particularities on the Ischia map, Ortelius and Mortier, following in the wake of their Italian predecessors, intended to serve specific needs that they had identified among a more or less restricted audience, which clearly took a great interest in Ischia and the Bay of Naples. From those curious about Ischia's volcanic properties and its implications for improving one's health, the particular characteristics that appear on the map would now have appealed to a 17th century audience that probably, like Säck a century later, appreciated it primarily as an aesthetically pleasing cartographic product that, in addition, allowed one to investigate the topography of certain parts of Europe in great detail. If anything, this map's particular nature clearly indicates the ongoing influence of Dee by the 17th century, established tradition of the Ptolemaic model, and points especially to the intrinsic, artistic, and commercial flexibility of the chorography concept. The success of individual maps and atlas books no doubt relied considerably on their connection with contemporary socio-cultural interests and practices, and on the extent to which they met the wishes of ensuing generations of collectors. As we have seen, cartographic editors during the 16th century for the first time presented selections of maps forming a coherent narrative within the pages of a bound book. The atlas format that was thus created formed the ideal physical container for sets of prints that resulted from their conscious arrangement by either publisher, printer, bookseller, or individual client. A process of careful selection was equally important for the creation and ensuing proliferation of a great variety of mural map cycles, including those at the Vatican, throughout Europe in this period. The physical appearance of these cycles depended heavily on the interaction between a wealthy patron and the ones responsible for the map's execution. For bound atlases, this mechanism could take a more indirect shape. The decisions of the publishers involved nevertheless remained strongly tied to the interests and status of their audience. In 17th century Amsterdam, center of the European book trade following in the wake of Antwerp, the challenges posed by emerging interpretations of the geography were taken up most ambitiously by the cartographer and printer-publisher Johan Blau. Johan, in fact, set out for his Atlas Major, the Cosmographia Blaviana, to treat areas all over the inhabited world, complemented, ideally, by sections on hydrography devoted to the seas and urinography, including celestial maps and descriptions of the heavens. Although Blau did make a head start on a chorographic subsection of his cosmography, including town atlases of the Low Countries and Italy, the Atlas Major eventually remained incomplete. The volumes that Johan Blau did manage to publish from 1662 onwards included only the geography, meant as the full atlas's first part, while the second and third parts, dedicated to the skies and the seas, were never issued as atlas books, although these sections are foreshadowed by the pairs of terrestrial and celestial globes issued earlier by the Blau firm. The success of the work that does remain, to a certain extent, perennially in progress, had to do with material features rather than with the Atlas Major's contents in a strictly geographical or scholarly sense. The volume's large size, excellent typography, and luxurious bindings, complemented by the fact that both maps and initials could receive additional colouring, as you see in this copy, by specialised craftsmen, quickly turned the atlas into a desired status symbol. Their outstanding appearance, in turn, secured the work's unrivalled contemporary reception, and may even be responsible for the preservation of great numbers of Blau atlases up to this day. For contemporary collectors, the monumental materiality of individual sets of volumes from the Atlas Major, ranging from the 12 books of the full French edition to 11 for the complete series in Latin, and 9 for the vernacular version in either Dutch or German, could be further supported through their storage in a purposefully constructed cabinet. The so-called Atlas Blau Atlas chests that on rare occasions turn up at private auctions, and of which examples survive in public collections in Amsterdam, Leiden and Leeuwarden.
Hmm. Wow.
The cabinet now held at the Provincial Library in Leeuwarden, sort of one on the right, I think, houses the 11-volume atlas that was originally gifted to the University of Franeker by Prince Johan Willem Friso of Orange in 1711, and is, to my knowledge, unique in being physically crowned, as you can see here, by the Atlasmeyer's full title at the top, thus physically testifying to the ongoing impact of the concepts, including cosmography, introduced by Ptolemy. In addition to bespoke safekeeping, the contents of any Atlasmeyer could be adjusted to individual taste by adding personal selections of images and texts to a compilation built up around a particular edition's standardized maps and descriptions. In this way, the relative scope of cosmography and chorography, reflected by the internal organization of an atlas, could be bent to suit a particular owner's interests. We can see this first at work in what is perhaps the most beautiful and certainly the most prestigious known copy of the Atlas Mayor. The Atlas Blau van der Hem that has been recognized as UNESCO World Heritage since 2003 and is currently preserved at the Austrian National Library in Vienna. Wait. This unique copy was compiled originally by its first owner, the influential and affluent Amsterdam lawyer Laurens van der Hem. After finishing his studies at the University of Louvain in what is now Belgium, van der Hem had travelled widely, including an extensive tour of Italy that is mirrored on paper by parts of his atlas. Within the assembled work, the Italian peninsula, and Sicily in particular, take pride of place. Apart from their detailed visual depiction, they are both described extensively. At home in Amsterdam, van der Hem's private residence, an imposing townhouse on the Herengracht in what is still a quite posh part of Amsterdam, soon acquired a status quite similar to that of a museum. It attracted various esteemed foreign visitors, including in 1668 the Tuscan Grand Duke Cosimo de' Medici, who took a great interest in the maritime and political advances of the Dutch Republic. Amongst the cartographic curiosities kept in van der Hem's extensive library, his greatly enhanced Blau Atlas in 50 volumes was certainly one of the main highlights. The collection on paper survives in its entirety and consists of 46 individual books, plus 4 additional, separately bound albums and a portfolio of drawings. Several editions of the Atlas Mayor form the core of van der Hem's atlas, which further contains land and sea maps printed by other publishers and countless manuscript maps and additional imagery that included material originating from the Dutch East India Company's private collections and that was thus understandably coveted by contemporaries. An example is this view of Fortzelandia on the island of Formosa, what is now Taiwan, that was officially governed by the East India Company between 1624 and 1662. I have in part selected this image not just because it shows the political value of the atlas, so not many contemporaries would have actually known what Taiwan looked like at the time, but also because it nicely flags up the ties between cartography and landscape painting in this period. Mm. Van der Hem made sure most of the material he assembled in his atlas received further treatment by Dirk Jansen van Zanten, an artist active as master colorist who through his work, as you can see on the map on this slide, subtly underlined the message behind the imagery to which he added a final conspicuous layer, thus contributing not just to the economic value of van der Hem's atlas, but equally adding to its overall symbolic significance. Van Zanten was the head of a professional workshop located quite closely to the Blau firm in central Amsterdam. But we also know that he worked at the direct service of van der Hem for a considerable period. Living under van der Hem's roof for many years, van Zanten must have received precise orders and was clearly provided with the most precious materials, including gold leaf, for work on the Atlas Blau van der Hem. The information that was accumulated by van der Hem in the shape of artfully adjusted atlas volumes brought the world, as known and unknown to the visitors of his home and library, closer and would have allowed him, just like those traversing the Vatican Galleria della Carta Geografica, to mentally travel through time and possibly space. The innovative character of the Atlas van der Hem is supported by its impressive materiality. including Van Zanten's splendid coloring, and underlines the deep connections between early modern art and cartography. The open-ended nature of the atlas ultimately allows both publisher and owner great liberty, not only in shaping the work's appearance per se, but more significantly in the narrative to be presented through a selection of cartographic imagery. In the hands of affluent owners, the book becomes an influential vehicle to portray individual erudition, socio-cultural prestige, and worldly power. The processes through which early modern atlases came into being depended on the complex collaboration between patron, publisher, and artist in their particular portrayal of geographical space after Ptolemy. The words of historical cartographer John Brian Harley may prove useful in thinking more generally about the map as a culturally charged carrier of geographical messages. The distinctions of class and power are engineered, reified, and legitimated in the map by means of cartographic science. The rule seems to be the more powerful, the more prominent. To those who have strength in the world shall be added strength in the map. We can begin to see how maps, like art, become a mechanism for defining social relationships, sustaining social rules, and strengthening social values. So I would like to just end on this note right now, because I think this quote ties in quite nicely with the questions that I started with. So are there any ideas, any impressions, questions? We can also just go back to the questions on my first slide. Is this something that you think you can generally agree with? The fact that maps are about much more than just portraying directly the places around us.
I was wondering how accurate the early maps were. Was it important to people collecting, really, or was it just something rather attractive that told them something about the world, the known world?
Well, I mean, you're touching upon something really quite relevant, actually, if you look at early modern maps, because it's really important you just always keep in mind the specific collector that would have been interested in a map. I mean, technically we know that most 16th century maps, they could already be quite accurate, but especially if you look into later collectors, as I do, it's quite striking, really, that people would collect maps that were not necessarily as accurate as they could be. So, yeah, you can very much see that personal taste and prestige played its part.
It's a bit like someone commissioning a work of art, like a painting. They would have influence on how it was presented. So I suppose it's something similar.
Yeah. There's clear ties. Yes,
it's just interesting how there have been so many produced to personal request.
I remember once seeing a beautiful antique leather globe in Antwerp. You're Dutch, I'm guessing.
I am.
My husband was born there, so we've got a lot of family in Holland and in Belgium. Yeah. And there's somebody's house in a very wealthy area of Antwerp. Mm-hmm. And there was this beautiful antique leather globe, which I assume...
That sounds very interesting. So do you happen to know what period that globe
is? I don't. the old lady died. Maybe one of my sister-in-laws might know. But it was her second husband, so I think it's unlikely
that she would know.
But it was really impressive.
How big was it?
Oh, I mean, it was, like this.
Oh, right.
Really, really big.
At what stage did the whole world map come in? Because most of these are just areas, aren't they?
Yeah.
They put it all together. What was the first?
The first world maps came about in the 16th century, I would say, around 1580. So that's really where Gerard Mercator comes in. He's the first cartographer to introduce a specific projection that allowed people to really visually present the entire, the sort of sphericity of the world on a map.
When they talk about Ptolemy doing longitude and latitudes, I didn't realise that was quite so known then. I thought it was later.
Yeah. No, that's really something that, I mean, it's really quite stunning if you think about it, but that's really something that even someone like Ptolemy in the 2nd century, they would have already theoretically know about that. I mean, of course,
so would they, the later ones worked on that and gradually expanded as the known world got bigger and bigger.
Exactly.
And how we found that out, longitude and latitude, how was, I can't begin to imagine how that could be worked out back then.
Well, it's
mathematically.
It was very much mathematically. In that sense, I have to say that I'm not really.
No.
I don't fully understand that because I'm not a mathematician. But it was it's really interesting if you think about the Renaissance and the rediscovery of perspective and what they did with that. The ways artists elaborated on that. I think it all forms part of the same.
I suppose the countries that, like Holland and England, who had the explorers, and Portugal and Spain as well, they explored the unknown world, so they were able to do some sort of basic maps. They would do maps of probably of the seas, where the narrows and the shoals were, and so on. But they would map the coastline, wouldn't they? Excuse me.
But what about the interiors of these land masses? Was that a guess or was it a...
Depends on the part of the world. Sometimes they were clearly still guessing. Especially when people start looking for the sort of for a passage to the Orient, basically, that's when they really start just. I mean, there's expeditions where people took maps, but those maps would just stop at a certain point, and then they just had to continue. They just had to keep sailing as far as they could, basically. And then, if they would make it, then you could improve your map afterwards. Yeah.
I was just watching the Germana Lumley Silk Road last night, and it's just fascinating. The road just goes straight across like that, and they know where it is. Amazing.
Yeah. What influence did the Islamic world have on maps? It's touched on here, I think, isn't it?
I've recently read some articles about that. It's really interesting. It comes through manuscripts that sort of very selectively seep into the West. So places like Venice, where you really have this sort of areas of contact, also in Spain. But those things really get known in Europe very, very slowly. And merchants bring those maps
It would be very difficult if somebody had gone off and discovered Australia. Nobody knew that they were telling the truth.
Well, James Cook was the first to circumnavigate New Zealand, wasn't he? And that was 17 something, isn't it? Are they well preserved because they were, you know, in wealthy places? Because by chance I've been to the county records office today. A friend won a guided tour, a private guided tour in some sort of auction or something. And have you been? I don't know if you've
I've
been.
Not been. No.
It just was so fascinating meeting the, I think they call conservators, I can't remember, she's Italian. And she'd actually worked in the States. I mean, they're so lucky, little old Warwick, to have this woman. And she was showing us all the Japanese papers and an old map where they sort of graft on the paper, where great big bits have been torn out of it, and it had a huge tear in the middle, and it's completely solid now. It took them 10 days to restore it.
Well, it very much depends on the materials, the quality of paper. If you go back to manuscript maps, those often don't really survive in a very good state. But the fortunate thing with atlases is because it's bound, it's also kind of the structure of the book that protects maps. So in that sense, the fact that I work on atlases is actually quite fortunate because it means that most of the maps that I look at are generally quite well preserved. Also because these atlases were not something that you would just casually, you know, you would pass it on to your children, basically, because they were so expensive and so prestigious.
So So would it be lots of copies of any particular atlas produced and sort of sold?
So for the case of the Atlas Major, which is something that I've been working on for some time now, we know that about 70 to 80 copies survive in libraries all over the world. And because we know that their survival rate is quite high, from that we can sort of roughly estimate that the original print run would not have been that much greater, probably, but it's still an estimate. Unfortunately, we don't really have the publisher's own sort of account books to see how many of them they actually printed.
I was just about to say, you answered that question. I wanted to know whether they were hand done or printed.
They were printed. Right. Then the interesting thing is that the colouring did happen by hand, so you really have the artist working with the printer.
Because the original ones, Cosimo and Gregory, they were having, when they put them on the cupboards, they must have had great detail with the artists. Put them on.
And what about, you know, the flora and fauna and the animals are depicted on these maps as well and in the border area. Where did that come from? Did that come from explorers that came back and said, in that part of Italy, there's such and such a plant? Or do they work very closely together?
So very much travelling merchants, explorers, but also just a lot of it was just bookish wisdom in the sense that people read older travel narratives or really all kinds of content that was just being read and handed over in that sense, without necessarily having been to those places.
So what's the link to what you might call political maps? When we start to see maps being used to draw the lines between one country and another?
So part of that relates to technical developments as well. So in the things that I look at, it's mostly towards the 18th century that maps become truly political. So I also look quite closely at patronage networks and how that influences maps. So I've looked at the Medici versus another Italian court, which is the Savoy in northern Italy. And at a certain point, you can really see that in the competition between their sort of houses, the Savoy have these incredibly sort of politically charged maps make that really sort of very strongly say, like, this is our border. And then sometimes even, you know, going beyond their own border, presenting it in a very strategic and very clever way to make it seem as though their area is actually a lot larger than it was. But that's really something that comes about 17th, 18th century, I would say.
So quite a bit later.
A bit later, yeah.
Than the maps that we've been talking about, which are serving quite a different purpose.
Would civic authorities need maps to say this is my area?
This is, but also just as a sense of civic pride. So just to sort of to say. For their own citizens to have something to say, like, well, I'm a part of this community, but also again, like, competition plays quite a large role in producing maps that portray cities in a certain way.
So it'd be quite interesting to look at how a community says this is us, and we are different to the other community, and so how these differences come about, because there must have been a time when that wasn't the case, and where there weren't the borders and quite a clear separation between this group and that group. And how all of that happened, and I would imagine that maps had in a way quite an influence on that, because it was a way of being able to represent it in a tangible way.
Mm-hmm. And then sort of reinforce that identity and that sense of, again, this is who we are, as opposed to another city nearby. Yes, that's very interesting, in fact. Yeah. And that's also something that I think relates so closely to choreography, in the sense that it's really nature and culture. So it's not just these are the tangible sort of walls of our city, but it's also about the citizenry and their sort of cultural traits. That's also where atlases are really interesting, in the sense that you have textual descriptions besides maps. So it's not just a map that shows that visually, but it's also a description that really sort of lauds your city and,
And hard borders.
Exactly.
Yes, a very, very...
What is considered to be the oldest map?
That depends, really. If you would ask a medievalist, they would go back to things like the Hereford Mapamundi. There's a very old Venetian map that was made by this monk that basically drew a map of the world without having left Venice himself. So that really depends. I mean, it's quite difficult to answer that question in a very straightforward way.
Didn't the Greeks have maps as well?
Yeah, and the Romans had maps in stone.
Maps in stone. So they had to be located where they were used.
Sure, to carry them.
Was that actually a sign of power too, that you could have a stone map?
I would imagine so. I'm not a classicist, but yeah, you could say that, I think.
Is there any evidence that say in the Renaissance that heads of armies would use a map if they were going? I mean, there was always a lot of rivalry between the states and the principalities. So I wondered whether maps would be useful to them or not.
I definitely think so, but in maps in a different way as we would understand them today. So first of all, that would be manuscript maps, and they would be a lot rougher in a textual sense than what we're used to today. So they would not have all the details, but they would just have, say, the enemy is located here. And then these things would have to be redrawn almost every day as battles continued, of course. So in a bit more of a flexible sense, but you could consider them maps if you think purely about how they were used. So they were used to locate people, locate movement.
Would it have also be advantageous to show the terrain? You know, if you've got an army and you've got a river or you've got a hill and a vantage point, so would they have access to that sort of information?
Well, depends, of course. I mean, the enemy could also just try very hard to keep that secret, which is why maps were not, they were not shared so easily between parties. Which is a bit hard to imagine, maybe, but if you think about early modern information, that's really, it's about hiding, it's about,
You mentioned cosmography, and I was just wondering how that affected maps of the heavens, because the church didn't agree with Galileo, did they? So the actual maps of the heavens were wrong, were they not? Until Galileo was his ideas were accepted. So that took some time.
Amazing. That's a very delicate point in the history of cartography. I mean, there's also maps that were made by certain cartographers, and we sort of know that they were very early in being in favor of Galileo, but they could not publicly issue these maps just yet. There's also maps that try to almost sort of reconcile two visions, in the sense that they present like a world map in the center, and then at the top and the bottom you have both sort of systems. And it's almost as if the publisher's trying to say, look, I'm neutral, but in this way you can judge for yourself. But no, that's really fascinating.
There would have been a difference, I think, with the Protestant North in Europe and
and Southern Europe,
yeah.
The Catholic countries.
Mm. Yeah, that's where the Inquisition comes in, of course, in the index. Yeah. And there were certainly maps in the north were certainly a bit more advanced at that point. Just because of what you could and could not publish and present to your audiences without being in danger. We know that Blau was quite early in presenting the world according to Galileo, but at the same time, cartographers in Italy could definitely, they could have not done that because they would have just, yeah.
What about early maps of the north? I mean, people like Leif Erikson that sailed from Iceland to discover the New World.
I have to admit that I don't really know that much about that.
Apparently it was quite easy because they'd sail from Norway to Iceland, which wasn't that far away, then straight over to Greenland, and then straight over to North America.
Probably wouldn't have had maps, I imagine.
Yeah. But apparently they could see the light because it was so far north that they just kept going.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, pretty chilly up there, actually.
Well, they were using the night skies, weren't they?
They were navigating by the stars. Yeah.
Yes.
So do we all just want to have our tea break at this point?
Bring that procession.
No. Tea.
Tea.
And a biscuit.
Thank you.
Where'd you get that from?
TK Maxx.
Really? Ooh. Very nice. Lovely nice colours, yes.
It's very, very useful.
Right, what should we do?
Oh. I'll push out that.
Yes, it's quite warm in this room.
I've got something that's too
warm.
It is lighter.
Yeah,
that's a hot thing. Oh, great, great questions, really. More than I can answer.
I mean, they were so much more ahead of us in one way.
In certain ways,
because they have to. We know we have the knowledge, but they had very little.